You know, it almost sounds like every time I stand in front of here, there's some more bad news. Many of you know Tuvia, who comes to the shmooze. His father, Mr. Gubin, who worked in the kitchen here for a long time. Unfortunately, he was nifter, and the family is sitting shiva. If you'd like the address, it's actually it's 75. I'll give you the address in just a second. It's 73, 35, 140, first place. Tuvia Gubin is sitting shiva. Mr. Gubin again was nifter. And we only hear good news. I think we should all have in mind, both during the Shir and especially during Maariv this evening, that the troops, our brothers in Eretz Yisrael, both the civilians and certainly the soldiers who are now engaging in a very, 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 very risky, dangerous situation, Hashem should be merachem on the Klal Yisrael, and specifically those who are in Sakana. When the Klal Yisrael left Mitzrayim, the first 31 days they ate matzah. That was the matzah that they baked as they exited. That matzah miraculously lasted well beyond anyone's expectation, day after day, week after week, until finally it was used up at the 31st day. At which point, HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe to tell the Klal Yisrael, they're now going to see wonders upon wonders. There's going to be man min hashamayim. This man, no one knew what it was. No one recognized it. It was rather unique. It fell from the heavens, and it was a marvelous, remarkable food. Totally absorbed within the body. No need to use the facilities. No waste. It tasted like whatever you wanted it to taste like. And the miraculous elements of it were rather numerous. No matter how much you collected, no matter how much you brought to your tent, it was an omer legogolis. Each person had a shear of an omer. If you collected a huge amount, if you collected a little, that was all that was there. It wouldn't last past the next day, unless it was Erev Shabbos, in which case you collected twice the amount. And each day, depending on where you were, it was stationed exactly based on your madrega. It was very difficult to sin in the midbar. Because if you were a very righteous person, the mun was right there. If you were, you had to walk a little bit. And if you were not as you should have been, you might have had to take quite a hike. And you can imagine it was a bit interesting if you had a next door neighbor who was known to be a very righteous individual. Day after day, he just opened the tent flaps and picked up his mun. And one day you see him open the tent flaps and he starts walking. Oh, you wore your rank right on your shirt sleeves. Everyone knew exactly who you were, and the mun was one tremendous part of the Gilui Shechina. What's interesting to note, though, is the expression that Moshe Rabbeinu uses to introduce the mun to the Klal Yisrael. The Moshe of Aaron al-Kol B'nei Yisrael, Moshe and Aaron said to the entire Klal Yisrael, Erev Yadatim. Tonight you'll know Ki Hashem Hutzi Eschem Eretz Mitzrayim. Tonight you'll know that Hashem took you out of Mitzrayim. All of the Rishonim are bothered by, what do you mean tonight you'll know? This is more than a month after Yetzias Mitzrayim. This is after Kriyas Yamsuf. This is after the Aniyah covered escorting the Jewish nation throughout their walks in the Midbar. Now you're going to know that it was Hashem that took you out of Mitzrayim? And the Sfarno explaining the Pasuk says as follows. This is actually a tefillah. Moshe Rabbeinu was mispalel, yehi ratzon, it should be the will of Hashem. That which he said, that he'll give you this mon min hashamayim, I only ask of Hashem that he gives you it in this particular way. Be'erev sarche erev, in the evening only enough food for the evening. In a way that you'll know that Hashem took you out of Mitzrayim, that Hashem took you out not just physically out of Mitzrayim, but that Hashem took you out of their minhagim, out of their ways, out of their customs, out of their habits. And why? Because the Sfarno explains, there when the Jewish nation was in the Mitzrayim, you were Yoshim al Sir HaBasar. You sat on the flesh pots. You were there. Would you be able to just ask the fellows outside? You sat there on the flesh pots and built these mansuda kavu without a set time for the meals. When you were in Mitzrayim, you ate, as the Gemara tells us later on, you ate like a tarnagol, like a chicken who would be menakir ba'ashba, chicken who would eat all day long. And therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu asked Hashem, give them only enough food so that they'll have their evening's food in the evening. They won't be able to act in this gluttonous manner. They won't be able to fress without a limit. Hashem, give them just enough food so that you'll take them out of the minhagim of Mitzrayim. What the Sfarno is bringing us into is an understanding that is a bit interesting. You see, Mitzrayim was a hedonistic society. They would party, but their partying surrounded around the activity called eating. And they would throw these major parties in which they would consume huge amounts of food, tremendous amounts of food. And interestingly enough, it was not the Greeks, but it was actually the ancient Egyptians who invented the vomitorium. You see, the party can only last as long as you can eat. If you eat rack after rack of beef, rack after rack, eventually the party has to end. So the ancient Egyptians invented a room where you went in and returned what you consumed so that the party can begin anew. Let's go! And they would rate themselves how the party was last night. Whoa, I went four times. Whoa, four times. I went three. What a party. It was great. And apparently, the Klal Yisrael learned this behavior. The concept of eating in a gluttonous manner, the concept of eating without even times for meals, just constantly consuming, eating, became something that the Jewish people adopted, learned. And Moshe Rabbeinu asked Hashem, please, when the month comes down, give them just enough food in the evening for the evening's meal so that they can no longer engage in this gluttonous behavior. And this will cure them. This will take them out of Minahageha, the customs of Mitzrayim. Now, the Rosh Yeshiva, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, asked a very interesting question on this Sfarno. And that question is, where were the Jews during the parties? Now let's imagine you're a Mitzri, and you're an invited guest, and they bring out the food, the trays are laden, rack after rack. It's a beautiful party. The Jews were not invited guests. They were the butlers, and they were the servants. They were the people who had to clean up the mess after it was done. If you ever speak to the child of an alcoholic, you can see a hatred for alcohol. Because the child of an alcoholic sees the damage, sees the dark side of it, and will swear off drinking to an extent that's hard to imagine because he's lived through the ugliness of it. But that was Rosh Yeshiva's question. You see, the Klal Yisrael lived through all of the ugliness of these activities. And they were not seated at the banquet table. They were the one who had to stand over the mitzvah bringing rack after rack as this behemoth fressed, ate and ate. They were the people who had to clean up the room where you returned and what you took in. They were the people who had to be there while all of this excess, these orgies were going on. Surely we would assume that the Jewish nation were disgusted by this. Surely we'd assume that the Klal Yisrael never would have learned this type of behavior, and this Sfarno would not seem to make any sense that the Jewish nation should have adopted this as their custom, as their way. And that was the Rosh Yeshiva's question. How could it be that if the Klal Yisrael were the waiters and the butlers, they learned this behavior and they needed the mun to free them from it? And I'd like to deal with that question this evening. And to deal with it, I'd like to mention something that's been I mentioned in a previous shmooze, but it bears repeating. One of the fathers of psychological behaviorism was a gentleman named B.F. Skinner. And he was a rather breakthrough and innovative thinker, but he was also a very clever guy. And I've seen a picture of one of his interesting experiments. See, Skinner, amongst behaviorists, claimed that much of our behavior is natural, instinctive, and it's imprinted into our nature. And one of his experiments actually showed this to a certain extent. And there are pictures of him walking across the college campus with a row of ducks in tow. Here's him and an entire row of little ducklings walking right behind him. Why? Because what Skinner did was, when the eggs would hatch, he sent the mother away and he presented himself there. And there is a certain window of time when the duckling will imprint on its mind. Hashem created within the nature of that animal a sort of imprinting ability where it's supposed to attach itself to its mother. In the natural world, what's supposed to happen is the egg, when it hatches, the little duckling comes out, sees its mother present, its mother is imprinted on it. Wherever the mother walks, so goes the duckling. And what Skinner did was, when the eggs hatched, shooed the mother away, put himself there, and these little ducklings imprinted upon him. In their mind, that was what they became affixed to, and then he would walk around campus with a row of ducklings following right behind him. Interesting experiment, which shows in a certain capacity within the animal kingdom to imprint, to see something as natural, and then adopt it as the normal way of things. And the reality is that to some extent there is such phenomena within human nature. Very sadly to say, if you study abused children, and if they take an abused child out of the home and put that child into a foster home, and assuming that the foster parents are kindly, good, caring, and loving, and then they give the child a choice, do you want to go back to your biological mother in that dysfunctional home where you were beaten, where you were scolded? Or do you wish to go back to the foster home where you were treated with love and kindness? Invariably, the child goes back to its biological mother or father, despite the pain and despite the memories, because that's home. The child was brought up there. The child lived there. That's mommy. That's home. That's where I belong. Despite the pain, despite the abuse, time after time, children will choose their biological parents because that's where they were brought up and that's what's normal. And there is this certain phenomena that we get accustomed to, and we adopt to, and we accept the surroundings as normal, proper, right. That's the way it's done. And this phenomena of imprinting or accepting things has quite a number of manifestations. I'd like to share with you one that may seem quite trivial, and may be trivial, but is eye-opening anyway. If you may note, women today dress in black. Black skirts and black shirts, black shoes. Especially in the frum world, the frummer, the blacker. You may assume that it's because they're very religious. You may assume because they're very tzenua. I'm sure they are, but that's actually not the cause of it. And we had some balas tshuva, some girls actually were not balas tshuva yet, they were from the University of Miami. And they were just coming to visit. And they noticed that all the Orthodox women were wearing black. Is that a religious thing? No, it's something called fashion. And as a matter of fact, my daughters, when we were passing a church not long ago, from afar, we saw the people coming out. And one of my daughters exclaimed, Masich Lefituma, she said, why are they dressed so fashionably? It was a funeral. And they were dressed so fashionably because they were attending a funeral. And if you think about it, gay colors, joyful colors, are yellows, pinks, reds. Black is rather depressing. Black is the appropriate color to wear at a funeral, at a shiva house, but it's not the appropriate color to wear on a spring day. And why is it that women wear black? Because it's something called fashion, and it's accepted, and it's in, and if I wear pink or green or yellow, I won't feel like I fit in. And while that may seem trivial, it's actually not. We human beings have an extraordinary need to conform, to fit in, but what shapes that which we need to fit into is this big thing called the world, society. Whatever our global picture is, whatever our world is defined by, we need to belong, we need to fit in, we accept it as regular, we accept it as normal, and that becomes the way it's done. And I believe that's how the Rosh Yeshiva answered this Sifuno. When the Jewish people grew up in Mitzrayim, yes, what they saw was ugly. It was abhorrent. It was disgusting. To watch grown men vomit is a very, very ugly thing to see. But that's the way things are done. And that's the way it's done in our world. And that became normal. It became the accepted practice to eat rack after rack of beef, to stuff yourself until there was literally no room left. That was the way it was done. That was normal. And despite the fact that the Jews did not have front row seats at that banquet, despite the fact that they were the butlers, they were the maids cleaning up, they saw this as the world, that's the way it's done. They learned those minhagim, they adopted them, and it required something like the mun only being enough food for the evening's meal to break them from that, and that's what Moshe Rabbeinu was mispalel for. And the Shiva pointed out that this is a very, very powerful influence. What we call social pressure, peer pressure, what's accepted in the world, what's done in the world, becomes reality for us, and no matter whether it makes sense or not, no matter whether we've chosen it or not, that becomes the right way of doing things, and that becomes the normal, accepted way that we do things. Now, with that being said, in 1764, Mayor Rothschild came back to Frankfurt. He had been in yeshiva. He was sent to yeshiva by his parents, and he did very well in yeshiva. Unfortunately, his parents died. And in 1764, he came back to Frankfurt, and I want to describe to you the scene. As he is about to cross the main river, he has to pay the Jew tax. As he walks through the Gentile section of town, all the little kids say to him, "Jew, do your duty," which means he has to step off the sidewalk, take off his hat, and bow. As he comes into the ghetto itself, the ghetto is 12 feet wide. That's the street of the ghetto. There are only 500 families that are allowed to live in the Jewish section of Frankfurt. And even those families are not allowed free rein. There are only 12 marriages a year permitted. The Jews are not allowed to do such exquisite, exclusive activities like farming or most trades. They're allowed to do very, very few activities. And at night, the gates are locked, barred, shut. Heaven forfend the Jew should exit the ghetto at night. And that is the world that Mayor Rothschild entered in 1764. For the next 200 years, the name Rothschild became synonymous with wealth, but not mere wealth as in excess. They say that the Rothschild family had more power than Napoleon, more power than many Caesars. They can make and break governments. The banking dynasty of the Rothschilds was such an international phenomenon that it literally controlled currency rates and much of what happened in the world. However, there's a real distinction between Mayor Rothschild and the next generations. Mayor Rothschild was a from Jew. Mayor Rothschild remembered very clearly from whence he came. Mayor Rothschild recognized very clearly who he was. And every night he would learn, and every Shabbos he was in shul, and he lived, breathed, and died a from Jew. However, his children, grandchildren, next generations were no longer anywhere near that. And many great philanthropic activities and was sponsored by the Rothschild that have no connection to anything that we believe in, anything Jewish, because they strayed away. And you see, one of the key distinctions between Mayor Rothschild and the next generations was where he came from. In the ghetto, in that small isolated world, he knew very clearly and very distinctly who he was. But his children and grandchildren had entree into all the courts of Europe. And they became not just members of court, honored, respected, revered people. And very quickly they changed. Very quickly they adopted the ways of the other nations. No longer could you recognize a Rothschild as anything Jewish other than very, very wealthy. And I think that this concept is very relevant to us. We, the Jewish nation, have enjoyed in the past 50, 60 years prosperity that is maybe unprecedented in history. We, as a large band, came from the Holocaust, those who came to America after the war came impoverished, penniless. Those who may have been here before weren't much better off. Those who came from other countries came to America as paupers, peddlers, penniless. And within a 50, 60-year span, we enjoyed such expanse, such wealth, that it is actually hard to envision and hard to imagine. And I don't want to focus on the extraordinary business success of the Jews right now. I want to stress one point. We've enjoyed a tremendous, tremendous lifestyle. And here's the question. Where did it lead us? Where did it bring us? I believe that there are two major costs that have come because of this wealth and because of this opulence. The first is how we rate ourselves. I was a young Kollel fellow when I vividly remember a breakfast conversation. And someone said to me, or I said to someone, how much money are you making? Oh, I'm making so much and so much. How much are you making? So much and so much. Try me on this one. Sit down at a bar mitzvah sometime next to a person you've never met before. Shalom Aleichem, how are you? Good. How much money do you make? What? How much money do you make? You rude boar? Really, how much money I make? The guy would stand up and walk away. I asked an innocent enough question. I just asked, how much money you made? Not like you have to get all hot under the collar, right? How much money you make, if it defines who you are, is a rather personal question. I'm a rich guy. I'm not so rich. I earn $50,000, maybe $150,000. You can't even imagine how much money I have. We live in a society that ranks its self-worth based on its net worth. Me, I'm worth $1 million. You'll hear people use those expressions. What's his net worth? What's his net worth? I don't know. What does he, depends what you mean. Do you mean the potassium, the chemicals in his body is worth about $6, maybe? No, I mean, what's his net worth? You know what I mean? Oh, you mean his value as a human being to contribute to the society and to change the world? No. I mean his cash, capital. Oh, that. Oh. And we define the human by one criteria: how much money he has in the bank, and what his portfolio is worth, how much money he has. And interestingly enough, this is not a Jewish virtue. I defy you to find me anywhere in the Torah that is the way you rate a human being. As a matter of fact, it's close to being sacrilegious. Because if you want to know the value of a human, it's been said many times here before, the value of a human is a Mishnah in Sanhedrin. Hashem says, I created Adam and Chava singular, just two individuals. Why? So that every human being afterwards should know it was worthy for me to create the entire world, the heavens, the earth, the rivers, the oceans, everything for one human being. That is the value of one human being, priceless, beyond any number you could ever place on a person. And when you define a person based on his stock portfolio, $100,000, $1 million, $10 million, and you are so shortchanging the human that it is close to sacrilegious. But we've adopted a custom amongst the Gentile nations that we live. We define our value based on our stocks, based on our savings. That's how much I'm worth. And we rate each other that way, and we look at people that way. And a very interesting thing happened in the past few months. You really don't know anymore, do you? He used to be very wealthy. He used to have very, very healthy portfolio. What's left? I don't know. What's going to be left tomorrow? He don't know either. And I found a very interesting experience. There are many, many people who have reputations as wealthy people, people of stature, people you have to respect because of their money, and it turns out, ve'enenu, it's no longer. And it's a very eye-opening experience, because what you begin doing is understanding how illusionary, how false, how much sheker is involved in that. A human being is not defined by his dollar bills after or before his name. And when you start doing that, you live in a false world of sheker, and at certain points the bubble bursts and you see it for the falseness that it is, and you recognize how silly it was. The story is told, I heard this in Rabbi Dvidowitz, there was a gentleman who lived in the time of the Vilna Gaon, who was a very, very wealthy Jew. And the city in which he lived got into trouble with the local Gentiles, which didn't take much at all. There was a tax that was put on the city. They couldn't raise the tax. And basically, the city was threatened that they would be killed out, man, woman, and child. And this Jew paid the entire tax himself. He ransomed off the town. At which point, recognizing the fact that he was a man of means and that he saved the town, he began acting differently and began dressing differently. A few years later, the event repeated itself. And a second time, he saved the town, and now he began wearing fancy robes. He began going in a gilded carriage. He began acting in a very, very different way because he was the man who saved the town twice. As things progressed, he heard about this man, the Vilna Gaon. He heard the reputation, and he sent out his gilded carriage with a messenger, hand-delivering an invitation to the Vilna Gaon, to an audience to come to visit himself. Needless to say, the Vilna Gaon did not get up and get in the gilded carriage and go to visit the man. So he sent another messenger, again inviting the Vilna Gaon to an audience with himself to come. The Vilna Gaon has the opportunity to meet with me. It happened a few more times. Finally, he realized not much is going to happen. A few more years passed. He heard more and more about the Vilna Gaon. He decided, for whatever which reason, to come himself, his honor himself, came to the Gro. And he shows up in his robes, with his royal entourage, as people walking him in, and he waits in the anteroom. The Vilna Gaon had a small room, and a little room outside it, and he waits. And the Gabbai was not exactly impressed with who the person was, and didn't feel there was any reason to change the Gro's schedule, and the man waited and waited, and began getting a bit annoyed. And finally, when whatever people had come first had gone through, then this person was introduced. He walks into the Vilna Gaon's office and a moment later comes back out and asks for a talus. The Gabbai says, sure. He gives him a talus. He puts the talus on, goes back in to speak to the Gro, and comes back out. And the Gabbai, when he came out, asked him, what's with the talus? And the man said, when I stood in front of the Gro, I felt like a buffoon. I felt like a clown wearing these clothes. I had to cover myself up. You see, every once in a while, there's a moment of brilliant clarity. There's a moment where I get it. My false, illusionary world blows up in the bubble that it was, and I see things with a piercing emiss, a piercing truth, and I see through the veil, I see through the illusion, and I get it. I believe that we have lived through a major market correction. I don't mean financially, I mean in our understanding of life, in our understanding of values, in our understanding of where life is at and how to rate ourselves. And I think whatever happens, this is an eye-opener for us to understand, to come to grips with how a Jew rates himself. And it ain't based on the bank book. But there's a second market correction. There's a second concept that we've adopted from the Gentiles that we live amongst. I try to have Bali Tshuva over as much as we can. We live close to our Sameach. I speak there. I try to have the fellows over. And every once in a while, there's some things that a Bali Tshuva will say that just makes you kind of open your ears and listen carefully. And one guy once said, how is it that all the Jews are so rich? I said, what do you mean? Look at these homes. Look at these cars. Look at the way they dress their kids. How is it that frum people are so rich? And I'd like to share with you the error in that thinking. It seems to me that frum people spend a lot of money. I don't know if they're rich or not. I know we live very, very opulent lifestyles. Our bar mitzvahs are very, very fancy. Our kids dress very, very well. We drive very, very nice cars, and our homes are very, very nice. And again, I don't believe that that is a Torah principle. Luxuries, excess, fanciness is not something, to my knowledge, that's a virtue extolled by the Torah. Now, let's not make any mistake. A human being, and certainly a Jew, must have dignity, must dress appropriately. If you're in a home, the home has to look nice and dignified. And if you wear a suit, it has to be respectable. But there's respectable, and then there's the $200,000 wedding. There's the opulence. There's the extraordinary amount of money in the children's matching outfits that all have to coordinate. And it's not my point to go on about the excesses. My point is, why is it done? And would you like to know why it's done? Because that's the bare minimum. I'd be embarrassed to have my kids show up in shul without matching outfits. That's what's done here. For me to drive a beat-up old car, I can't do it. Because it's a shanda. For me not to have my interior decorated every couple of years, just it's not pas. And for me to make a wedding and not with at least a hot shmorg, at least, is just not respectable. And you see, we've created this very, very luxurious lifestyle that's self-supporting, that requires us all to spend money that we have or don't have, but that's inappropriate. And that comes with a very, very great cost. And that cost ultimately is the focus of our life and what we do with our time. I heard someone, I don't know exactly the details, but I heard the story told over that someone recently came to Rav Chaim Kanievsky saying, Rebbe, I lost $80 million. And Rav Chaim Kanievsky's reaction was, oy, what you could have done with the money, why didn't you give it to yeshivas? You had it. You could have changed the world. And what happened? Now it's gone. And in that moment of getting it, and then the person understood. And the Chovas Levavos explains to us, we're given money for three different expenses. My own support, support of my children, and then there's extra money that's given to me. And when you confuse the three and make it all one big pot, it's all about my needs, my expenses, and what I need for now, for the future, you get very confused and you mix things up. There was a young man in Kollel whose mother was very generous, and she bought the children the outfits for Pesach, all matching, all beautiful. And at a certain point, the fellow said, but Mom, it's so goyish to dress them so fancy. And his mother said, goyish? Only the Jews do this. Goyim don't buy this kind of clothing. And it's shocking to note that we, the Am HaNivchar, the chosen people, the people of extraordinary values, the people of real depth, have adopted from amongst the nations that we've lived a certain lifestyle, and we've upped it and improved upon it and really, really brought it up to the level that the Goyim look at us and go, wow, that's astounding. And gentlemen, it is not Jewish. It is not a Jewish virtue. It's not the Jewish way of doing things. It is a Gentile practice, a foreign culture that's become accepted in our communities, in our circle, because that's the way it's done. And once you accept it, once it becomes adopted, it's natural, it's normal, and we forget how off it is. And much like the Sforno is telling us, the Jews living in Mitzrayim looked at these orgies, these food orgies, as normal, because that's the way they were brought up. That reality has become part of our reality. We rate people based on their dollar amount, and we look at luxuries as the bare necessities. And there's a very interesting thing. You ever hear the expression, he's a man of means? He's a man of means. I heard a better one just recently. I didn't realize it. He's really a man of substance. Now, you know what a man of substance means? Like a man of substance, like a big pot belly. That's what I expected. He's a man of substance. And what he meant was he's got some money, or he had some money, in his bank account. He's a man of substance. You see, substance means who you are, how much character you have, how much learning you have under your belt, how much chesed you do. What defines you as a human being is how much of a man of substance you are. And amazingly, that expression has come to mean such a frivolous, such a non-Jewish concept. And I think there is a very real taking of stock that we have to do, some coming to grips. And I want to share with you one more thought. It's a comment that the Sforna makes. And when Hashem tells the Klai Yisrael that He's going to bring man, Hashem says, I'm going to bring lechem min hashamayim, bread from the heavens. And why am I going to do this? Leman anasenu, I'm going to test you. Hayelech b'torasi in lo, if you're going to go in the ways of the Torah or not. And the Sforna explains, what is the test? And what does it mean? Hashem says, I'm going to give you bread from the heavens to test you whether you'll go in the ways of Torah. And says the Sforna, k'shiyem esparne shelo b'tzar, when you'll be sustained without pain, and when your income, when your sustenance will come without much effort, that's the test. And you see, the test of the man was, it's easy, you don't have to work very hard. Your lechem comes min hashamayim, that's the test. Now that you have it good, now that you have it well, are you going to follow in the ways of the Torah? And Baruch Hashem, I dare say, that on many, many counts, the Klai Yisrael has come out with flying colors. Our yeshivas flourish and expand. Chesed projects are beyond description. You can't open a Jewish newspaper without seeing gemachs and all types of good activities. And people spend an awful lot of their time, resources, energy, doing many, many great things. And in that sense, I hope we've come out of this test of the past 50, 60 years of having it lo bitzar, having our parnosa come easily, and hopefully we've passed with flying colors. However, I think there is one area that we've been deficient in, and that is part of our value system, the opulence and luxury in which we live. And if you'd like to understand the market correction that we're living in right now, I believe part of it is for us to wake up, realize and recognize the values of a Jew, the concepts that we live with, that which is integral and that which isn't. And that is something to think about as the Tao tumbles, as the world begins to shake. I think there's a tremendous lesson to learn from the Sforna. What he's sharing with us is that that which you grow up in looks normal, looks regular, it becomes imprinted. Much like that little duckling that looked at B.F. Skinner and said, that's mommy, and what you grow up in, and what you become of age amongst, looks normal, looks regular. If you take a foster child and you bring them up in a loving home, but they were brought up first, exposed first to an abusive parent, the abusive parent is mommy, because what you grow up in looks normal, looks regular. And as the Sforna explains to us, that's why the Klai Yisrael needed to be extracted from these food orgies. And I believe the application of this in our own world is very, very powerful. There was a man called Meir Rothschild who wasn't destroyed because he had a very peculiar upbringing. He was rooted in Torah. He had a very solid background. The generations afterwards weren't. And I believe a major test for us in the past 50, 60 years has been exactly this point. What do you do now that it's good? What do you do now that it's easy to earn a parnasa? I don't think in the course of history has it ever been this easy to earn a living. And yes, we work hard, but our working hard is not in the sweat mills. Our working hard is not in the sweatshops, toiling for 14 hours over a sewing machine, or working the fields for hours and hours and hours, unending back-breaking work. Our work has been very, very easy, and it's come to us lo bitzar. And again, Baruch Hashem, in many ways, we've excelled and succeeded, but in two areas, I believe we need a market correction in our value system and in the way that we spend our money. I'd like to close with a story that I read. I first heard Rabbi Kron say it, and then I called him up because I had to read it again. And it's in one of the Magid books. The story basically is like this. There was a Rebbe of an 8th grade class who went to the bar mitzvah of one of the boys in his class. And when the bar mitzvah was all over and everyone went home, he noticed that the father sort of put his head down and had a very, very pensive sort of look about him. And the Rebbe went over to the father and saw that the father really had a lot on his mind. And the father just stood there. And the Rebbe, realizing that the father needed some time, was about to step away, but the father began speaking. He said, "I want to tell you something about my son. You probably note that my son is not so tall." As a matter of fact, the Rebbe did note that this boy was the shortest in the class. From the time he was born premature. He had major, major health issues. And quite a number of years ago, we recognized the fact that he was much shorter than everyone else in the class. Much shorter, to the extent that he was being mocked, he was being made fun of, they were calling him shorty and shrimp. And we decided that we were going to look into the idea of having him get growth hormones to allow him to grow. And we researched it. We found out there were some issues, pro and con. Pro being he would grow, con, it might be dangerous, there might be certain repercussions. This was back in 1985. It was very unproven at that point. And we went to Mount Sinai Hospital to the top endocrinologist in the field. And I made an appointment with her. It took me months to get in. I finally got in, and through an entire battery of tests, she put my son back and forth. And at the final conference, I sat with her and discussed the issue, should I or shouldn't I? And she was very frank. She said, "We don't really know the implications. We know it works. We don't know the long-term health care." At which point I said to her, "Okay, doctor, forget you're a doctor. As a mother, if this were your child, would you have him take the growth hormones or not?" And the father said, I saw a tear in her eye. And I pressed her and I said, "Tell me, as a mother, if it were your child, would you do this?" And she began crying. And she said, "You have to understand, if it were my child, I would have to do this. I live in a Scarsdale community. In Scarsdale, everything is rated by your first impression. How tall, how handsome, how well-dressed. I would have no choice. But you're different. You come from a different background. You're the people of the book. Your people rate other things, intelligence, character. If I were the mother of this child in your world, I would never allow him to do it." And the father said he learned a great Musa lesson from that event. And that Musa lesson really is very powerful. And that is, if you live in a Scarsdale world where exterior matters, then that's where your world is at. But that's not our world. Our world is far deeper, far more significant, far more basic to what a human being was put on the planet for. And one of the secrets of this last stage in the exile is not to adopt the ways of the countries in which we live, not to adopt the Gentile way, to keep to our ways, which is true value and true understanding. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu grant us understanding, wisdom, and ability to put this into practice.